morning, Schwartzy. I'm kind of excited.
Are you?
Yeah, I don't know.
We get the pump primed here. And
yeah, you're not.
We're all speaking the common language here.
Exactly. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Will. How are you?
I'm good, sir. Gary Winkler? Winkler? That's not hard to say.
Winkler, yeah, with a C. There's a C in there that kind of throws people off. Not like Henry Winkler, W-I-N-C-K-L-E-R. So Gary is a saddle maker from North Idaho. But you grew up in Washington State, right, years ago, and then wound up in a career with in major college athletics. And even we'll talk more about this. I think this Gary's so understated about all this stuff, but former Big Ten Coach of the Year, track coach, and going down to Florida State. You started out Oregon State, Florida State, and then University of Illinois. Did I get that correct?
You got that correct. Yeah, I was a graduate student studying mathematics at Oregon State, and then I was volunteer coaching with the track team there. And that opened some doors for me to meet some people, and I got offered a full-time coaching job at Florida State while I was still in graduate school.
Wow.
So I was working on a PhD in mathematics, and then when I got the offer for the job at Florida State, it was kind of too good to pass up because I knew I wanted to coach. And so I hurriedly finished a master's degree in mathematics and packed my wife and everything we had into a U-Haul trailer and drove to Florida.
Exciting. Bit of climate change from growing up in Washington State.
It was. We got down to Florida, and all I had was winter clothing, and it didn't take long for me to figure out I had to do something different.
Humidity was a little greater. There was a lot.
Oh, yeah. On the trip down, we had driven to San Diego to see family members, and then we drove all the way across the southern U.S., and it was August of 1980, and they were having, it was all triple-digit temperatures through all across Texas, so we were trying to drive at night because neither one of our vehicles had air conditioning.
Wow.
So we were driving at night and then trying to sleep during the day, and it was not a fun journey.
Well, if you came through my part of Texas at night, which would have been highly recommended without an air conditioner, I promise. It would have been cool, though. It was desert, but it's a long drive from El Paso to the first place where you could rest for the day. I can say that.
Yeah, you come out of El Paso and you see that sign, next gas, 260.
I was 50 miles north of that place, just so you know. Yeah.
Well, that would have been Fort Davis?
Well, I did grow up in Fort Davis. You wouldn't have passed through there, though. On the interstate, you'd have Van Horn's 100 miles, and then you'd see there's Kent and there's Balmoray, but if you were...
Yeah, I know we stopped at one place. I can't remember it. It was
Fort Stockton, maybe.
Fort Stockton, and there was zero visibility. The wind was blowing so strong. There was a big dust storm, and so we just hunkered down.
could have been Fort Stockton for sure. It was that way this last weekend too. They were talking about it, and this front that's moved in. They said you couldn't see anything. It was a lovely day in paradise, they said.
Yeah.
Well.
But anyway, that's how we ended up in Florida. Stayed there for about 5 years, and then we got recruited to Illinois. So we were there for about 25 years.
Oh, wow. Coaching the whole time?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that says a lot, because the coaching career can be short-lived and quite nomadic if you're not careful, right?
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, no, I had good people to work for, and I had good people that assisted me, and we were able to have a lot of success at Illinois. And we won a couple national championships at Florida State, but at Illinois, I think we finished fourth in the nation on two occasions, and we won about 11 Big Ten championships.
Hmm. That's awesome.
It was a good place to raise our family, and eventually in 2008, I got tired of the NCAA and all their shenanigans, so it was time for me to move on. So we elected to come back home to the Northwest, which is where my wife and I are both from.
I mean, all that's making complete sense, but then we're going to throw saddle making in on it, and I'm kind of having a hard time connecting those dots.
Well, that goes back quite a ways, though, doesn't it? Gary entered Illinois.
Yeah, back in 1996, we had just in the early 90s, we were finally able to acquire a place outside of the university town there, where I could finally get a horse. We'd never had enough, or never had the ability to have land or a place to have a horse. So then we found this 5-acre place and that had a barn and some pastures. So I figured I could finally get a horse, and then I got a horse and I bought my first saddle. It was a Billy Cook I bought out of the local tack store, and boy, it was uncomfortable. And that got me interested in what can you do to make this more comfortable? The local tack store there had a saddle repair guy named George Hast. George was a former ag teacher at one of the local high schools, and then when he retired, he started doing repair work there. And he'd only built a couple of saddles, but he did a lot of repair work. And so I went into him, and I was talking about this whole deal, and I came back a couple weeks later and said, George, would you help me learn how to build a saddle? And, you know, he kind of hemmed and hawed, and I said, I'll think about it. Mm-hmm. Well, he made me come back there about 6 times. And finally, he realized I was serious about it. Mm-hmm. And so we agreed that, we agreed on what I'd pay him. And we would meet 1 hour, or we'd meet one night a week for a couple hours. And we'd start doing this. So after 2 years, we'd built a saddle.
Wow.
And he taught me all the skills. And I tell people that I really feel fortunate having the opportunity to learn from him, because of the fact that he was primarily a repair guy. I could come into his shop and I could see the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, he would have all these different kinds of rigs torn apart, and you would see just how you could do things well and how things could be taken a lot of shortcuts and done poorly. So it was a great way to learn. And then whenever I would come out to the West to visit my family, my folks and my brothers and sisters all live in Washington, I would usually drive out and I would try to stop and visit with a saddle maker, anybody that would let me in their shop. And there weren't very many that would. Hmm. I'd just stop and visit with them for maybe a few hours or a day and just kind of pick up things.
Sure. Well, how times have changed that way, right? I'm not going to say all shops are open, but it feels that way.
I think people are a lot more open now than they were, mm-hmm. 30 years ago.
For sure.
But anyway, getting back to saddle making, I knew I wanted to have something to do when I quit coaching, because I saw too many of my coaching colleagues that would think, okay, well, I'm going to retire from coaching and I'm going to play golf every day. They were dead in about 2 years.
Yeah.
Because, when you stop using your mind, you kind of stop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see it all the time, and retirement. I retired at 25. I've been working my butt off ever since, building these bits and spurs to keep from getting that real job. Right? I mean, that's and I make fun and I giggle about it, but I'm serious about that too. I love doing what I do, but retire, like, work doesn't have to be a bad word. It's a lot of fun. No, I don't always want to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to make a living. I would like to ease up on that little work schedule as I move and progress through life. But stop and just play golf? No,
I don't remember ever reading anything in the Bible about retirement.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly. I don't believe in it.
No. That's awesome. Yeah. Good for you.
100%. Yeah, it's we're just hardwired to do something with our mind, with our hands and stuff, and find ways to serve our neighbor and all that good stuff. And my dad was cutting wood at 80, cutting wood for other people, never did burn wood himself, but firewood, cut wood for people when he was 87, and last until he was 88. And they just keep her going. And the worst job you can have is no job, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Now, yeah, I've got a friend right now who's a close friend. He's in the does a lot of electrical. He's got an electrical business, electrical contracting business, and you know, he's selling off his business, but he's really struggling with this whole idea of moving on to something else. He can't decide, but yet he understands that he needs to move on to something else. So it can be a struggle if you don't plan for it.
Well, you had you also did some consulting with the Canadian Olympic team and some of that. You did some contract work after you retired, correct?
Yep, that's the best job you can ever have.
I can imagine.
Yeah, when I quit coaching, it was about 6 months after that the Canadian Track and Field Association contacted me, and they wanted to know if I'd be interested in doing consulting. So it was basically quarter-time work. You know, I would travel with them and do training camps in Arizona or wherever. I would go up to Canada once in a while, but most of the stuff was down here. They wanted to come south where the weather was better, and we would have training camps. I would do speaking engagements and clinics, and then I would travel with them to the major championships and help coach the team. But yeah, that was great. I mean, that's actually what allowed me to pay for my new barn when we moved to Idaho and get horses again. So
perfect.
Well, that was fun. So I worked with them from 2009 until after the London Olympics in 2012.
That's cool. So you've obviously worked with some incredible athletes, and I get into the mental side of things, right? I feel like there's if you're going to be the whole enchilada, if you're going to be able to do it all and you're going to be successful at it, there's a lot that goes into it other than the word talent. Like, I kind of hate the word talent. I do not like talent. Talent.
I agree. Yeah.
It just, that people, when they say, "You're so talented, Willie, you think I woke up like this?" Right? I mean, that's the first thing that goes through my mind. Right? So what, you had national champions. What created that individual? What are the characteristics that you see that would, as a coach from the outside looking in?
When I look at my athletes that had the most success,
yeah,
in terms of making Olympic teams, winning world championships, etc., those are the people that showed up to work every day.
Yeah.
And they worked hard, and they just didn't give up. They had just a great competitive attitude, okay? You know, it didn't matter if you were going to sit down and play a game of cards or whatever. They hated to lose.
Hated, yeah.
You know, and the athletes that I had that had the most success on the track were not the most talented people I had.
Yeah.
I had many individuals that athletic talent-wise were just off the charts. They didn't have the discipline.
Yep.
You know?
I was hoping you would say all of that. I nearly said it for you, and I thought, no, I'm going to let you say it itself. But I wanted you to say it. That's awesome. Because that's what I feel like, too.
Yeah, there's something about the struggle. I mean, it's when I was in graduate school, I was in a mathematics department, and I had an assistantship there. So we had an office with other grad students. And what they always said is, you know, if you can't do it, teach it.
Yeah.
Because even in mathematics, the people that were very bright and could just grasp these concepts very easily, they were terrible teachers. Mm-hmm. Because to them it came to them so easily, they didn't have to think about how to explain it to somebody else. Yeah. So yeah.
I you go, you Schwartzy, I could go on.
Well, you I think you said the word consistency, you know, they, or maybe at least alluded to it, is that mm-hmm. show up for work every day. I don't think you can overstate the value of consistency. You just have to, I mean, I use the word grind, but there does have to be a therapeutic benefit, of course. It's not like you have to browbeat yourself to show up for work every day. There's to be something in it, you know, something, like Gary said, that drive to win in athletics. And, of course, we're not trying to win anything in craftsmanship other than maybe win the day, you know, win, you know, personal victories, I suppose you might say, day in, day out and stuff. But how do you net that? And it's that consistency to show up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I look at building saddles or the Western crafts, very similar to how I looked at athletics, in that I probably was a little different as a coach than many were. I never really had my athletes set goals. To me, the goal, there was just one goal, and that was to get better every day. And because I saw too many people that would set solid goals, and then they might achieve that goal, say in the qualifying meet before the championship, and they achieved this goal they've been working at for years, and it's like it was a letdown.
Yeah.
And then the next week at the championship meet, they wouldn't perform well because they'd already achieved that goal. So that goal to me was a barrier.
And so, interesting.
Exactly how I feel.
I don't set solid goals. I mean, the goal is just try to get better tomorrow. You know, who can I call today and learn something else? You know, I'm getting ready to take a trip down to visit a saddle maker in Oregon here in the next couple of weeks and try to learn something that he does well that I don't do as well. So it's just, to me, that's what makes it fun.
Mm-hmm. It's a journey, not a destination that way.
Yes, I
tell people a lot of time, Gary, that if I wanted to be the best bitten sperm maker in the world, if that was my goal, I achieved that 2 days into it because my mama thought I was the best bitten sperm maker in the world, right? And that would have been limited. I'd have been limited from then on. Yeah. Now, I have learned something in the last couple of years through business, and Mike Skinner, my business consultant, has helped me set some goals that have been very rewarding in the business, but they're moving targets, and they mm-hmm. they're reevaluated every year. And so, okay, you did, and his attitude is okay, you did, as my dad always said, that's nice, son, but, and now we got to make that better. Right. And you got to make that better. And so each and every year the business has to grow. And it's been fun to set those goals, but I've now been challenged by some other parts of my life that, what's the ultimate happy? What's the ultimate? And I'm scared of that because of what you say. What are you trying to create in a business? What are you trying? And this isn't coming from Mike, but what are you trying to create, at 65 years old? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know how to define that. I mean, because I'm vague like you. I'm trying to become the best I can be each and every day, and I have no idea what that is, business wise or craft wise. I don't know how to define that, and I'm scared to define it because I don't want to limit myself.
Yeah, and I don't know that we need to define it. I think. Community. I mean, what you guys are doing in the TCAA, you've got a community of people you work with. And I think those, you'd probably agree with me that those people really inspire you. They help you to keep moving on. Sure. Probably have new ways of looking at things each year. You get new ideas. And my community is not as large as I'd like it to be, but still, you know, there's people I can call or I can look up the work that you guys do and I can get inspired. Oh, yeah, that's a nice look, a little element he put there in his engraving. I get a lot of my inspiration from engravers.
Sure, cool.
Because I try to incorporate that in my leather work because it's just, it's different. And I think engraving is just, it's just incredible artistic work that goes on in that.
Well, you don't like Carrie's tooling at all then, do you? I mean, he's so far off course.
I like his tooling. I know what I like about it is when you see Carrie's saddle, you know immediately it's Carrie's work.
The similarities between Carrie's designs and what I aspire to be as an engraver is so similar. I've learned mm-hmm. so much from Carrie too, and I believe that the acanthus leaf and those ornamental designs all stem from the same place, you know, the acanthus leaf, but mm-hmm. whether it's leather and silver, and there's been things that our Western culture, like the Western bright cut, is a very impressionistic style of engraving. It's not as exact, you know, type mm-hmm. stuff. And so a lot of our Western culture kind of lean that way, more economical, quicker layout type of stuff. But it all came from the same place, I think.
Yeah. No, it's infinite possibilities out there.
Sure.
You know, something that before it gets away from me, and we talked about, the lack of setting goals. Boy, that's 180 degrees opposite of so much of the business advice out there, right? And Gary, you just lined out a scenario where you've got an athlete that achieved, a conference championship, and then they have a national meet coming up, and check that box. So, and there's an element in that that's really interesting, isn't it? That whole scenario where you're resting on your laurels, you're celebrating a victory, and you've checked that box, and is that not looking back? You're looking back instead of ahead.
Yeah.
When you said a moment ago, Gary, what am I going to do tomorrow that's a little bit better than today?
Yeah.
And it's all headed one direction. It's all headed forward.
Yeah.
And that's where... Yeah, I think I attribute this at least in part to kind of this artsy-fartsy mentality that I have. I can't even tell you sometimes exactly what I did last year, because I cut emotional ties to that work. Mm-hmm. Because I'm, number one, in the moment, and secondly, I'm looking at what I can do better on the next project.
Yeah.
That inertia, that momentum is always forward. I think that's all a fascinating study of that. But
no, I'm very similar. I mean, people will call me once in a while, and they're going to buy one of my used saddles. Someone's going to sell a saddle I built maybe 10 years ago, and I got to go back and look through all the pictures and everything to just even remember what that thing was about.
Oh yeah, me too.
Yep. You just move on. You just cut emotional ties to that work, and just find a way to one foot in front of the other. Just
work my life moving forward. Pictures of everything I do. Otherwise, I just have no idea when I did it or what it looked like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there has to be a level of accountability, personal accountability that you hold yourself to, right? It's like you're every mm-hmm. day. It's like you're moving forward. And as a coach, I'm sure you. You had that challenge daily. There were certain individuals that were easier to hold accountable than others.
There were, you know, and even as you, myself as a coach, I mean, it was a little easier to hold yourself accountable because you have, you know, you've got the athletic director, you've got all the people on the team, you've got assistant coaches, you've got the news media. They're all going to hold you accountable.
Yeah.
So it's a little easier. You've got people behind you reminding you every day, you better win this or you better do that or this.
Yeah.
You know, I much prefer working alone like I am now, because I've never needed anybody outside myself to motivate me. I've never needed that.
Yeah. It floors me why people do. But I'm going to talk out the other side of my mouth here in a second. Like people would say, why do you get up so early? Well, I have to, right? I don't want to get a real job. I love doing what I do. So, you would have to do it for somebody else. Why not do it for yourself? Now, when Mike started working with me, he doubled my income within a couple weeks, because he held me accountable to 40 billable hours a week. I have known my entire career that I needed to get 40 billable hours a week. That's what the normal everyday world does. But I always, because of the goals, and I had set it backwards of what I had to do instead of what I could do, my goals, I had to produce 20, 25 hours a week to make to pay the bills and hold it zero. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't figure out how come I was always at zero and not past it. Right? Well, that Mike got into my life and started helping me, and he said, hey, I need 40 billable hours a week. I can't do that. He said, you got to do that. I don't want any excuses. Go to work. And the challenge, so I like challenges. Away I went. Within 2 weeks, I'm 40 billable hours a week, and basically been doing that every week since then without interruptions for mm-hmm. 2 years now. And So he was my basic coach to simply hold me accountable. And I would like to think of myself as a self-disciplined guy who doesn't need that. I guess I did. And it made me mad that I couldn't do it myself.
The thing with that is it was the metric. It was measurable.
Yeah, it was measurable.
And that's that's important, I'm sure, in coaching or anything, is to find a way to measure what I've done, what I did tomorrow, and accomplish what I did yesterday. I think there's a study of that has to happen, doesn't it, Gary?
Yeah, and throughout my, even my coaching career, and even now with my salad making, it's, I have the opposite problem that Willie has, and that I tend to put more like 50 or 60 hours a week in, and then not realizing that I'm probably wasting 20 of those hours doing stuff I really don't need to be doing.
Well,
you know, when I was teaching coaching courses, a point I would always try to make them, the people in the class, is that, you know, there's the need to do and there's the nice to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to make sure you take care of the need to do first. And then if you still got time in your week, you could maybe address the nice to do stuff. And I think sometimes a problem I've had is I spend too much time on the nice to do, because that's kind of the stuff you really want to do.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're really focused on the need to do, you maybe you don't need to put in as many hours.
I'm putting in 75 to 80 hours a week to get my 40. And the focus is actually, how can I get paid for more of what it is that I'm doing, right? And I don't mean paid as in it's all about money, but we call quote unquote billable hours. It's working towards producing a given product. And we are the CEO/janitor. The only guy that's creating billable hours is the guy in the middle that's actually producing. Mm-hmm. The CEO doesn't create billable hours. He creates value. And then the janitor cleans up all the mess, you know, and I got to do all those things, but it is the daily focus, the daily challenge is how like this podcast is a treasure in my week. I love it. And like getting a visit with you and talk about the mental side of this is a huge value to me. I get to charge nothing for it. It has created no billable income for the business, you know, but so I wouldn't trade it for the world. But how do you incorporate more activities in the day that do work into the bottom line of the business is you know, not a challenge, but I'm always looking at it, you know, how to maximize those hours.
That's good. That's great.
I guess
in some sense, these visits we have weekly are a little bit of an accountability factor, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about them and okay.
Yeah.
Now it's game time.
Yeah, well,
the sports metaphor, but okay, we got to get this done.
Well, and you run your big. I run my big mouth. You tend to choose your words wisely. I run my big mouth, and then all of a sudden, I've said this stuff. So now I got to go do it. Right. So there's the accountability. Well, do you draw regularly, Gary? How's that? What's your routine there with design?
Yeah, you know, I don't draw as much as I should. I've been, I think I had this conversation with Carrie on the phone the other day or earlier. In the last year, I've had a lot of trouble with my hands and my arms, and it really showed up last spring. You know, I've been doing a lot of tooling work, and that, you know, I go to chiropractor and I go to massage therapy and try to maintain it. But then last spring when I was doing a lot of roping, it really irritated it a lot. So now I'm really motivated to try to get my hands and my arms better. So I'm trying to minimize the work I do with my hands. So I'm not drawing as much. You know, I'm trying to really be careful when I'm tooling that I don't sit there and tool for 8 hours straight, you know, trying to break up my days a little bit more and maybe instead of making 12 saddles a year, cut that back down to 6 to 8 saddles a year and just try to be a little more selective about my work. But yeah, it's
been, I don't know where I heard or saw this, somewhere online, I'm sure, but somebody was making the case that the best runners, the best track athletes are the ones who slow down at a slower rate. So they're able to maintain, you know, that pace for a longer period of time, and it makes sense. And what you just described, Gary, is what I'm trying to do. You're a little bit older than me, and is to slow down at a slower pace, to try to keep a pace that is sustainable. Isn't that what you just described?
Yeah, I'm trying to slow down on my own cognition rather than having it just force me to stop.
Right, right.
I don't want to get to that point where I can't do anything because I really enjoy what I'm doing. So just manage it, slow down to the point where you can just keep doing it and keep moving forward.
I heard that described about Usain Bolt. He just didn't slow down as fast as everybody else. Just kept going.
Yeah. Because getting old is it's the toughest journey we take.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
My dad was 96 and a half. I had an aunt that was 102. My mom's still alive. She's 94. And when you spend a lot of time around people in that age bracket, you realize that's when life gets tough.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Boy, we think we have some tough days now. every minute, every day is tough.
Yeah.
I got a mom's 84 and an aunt that's 87, sisters, and they're still full throttle. And but so longevity's there in the family as well. But I have a neighbor lives across the river from me, and he's 93, and he says it's hard, Willie. He said, just be careful. He said, old hurts. Old hurts. But it's a privilege, and I can promise
it is.
I am so thankful of my older generations that are still around. You know, I mean, it's just, there's a lot to learn.
Oh, you know, boy, you nailed it on the head. I think of all the times when I wish I'd spent more time just sitting down with my dad and asking questions, you know, about, you know, they grew up in the 20s and the 30s of the previous century, and so much to be learned. And when I was coaching, my best coaching colleagues were all 20 years older than me.
Yeah.
I hung around the old guys because the old guys are the ones you learn from.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
The young guys, we just all got a bunch of opinions, but the old guys have been there. They know. You know, you take advantage.
What Gary just said is gold. I'll tell you what, if I have any advice for young people is look at those ahead of you. And a metaphor you've heard me say this probably before is that what I'm trying to do in my life is you're riding down this trail and you get whacked in the head by a limb and you turn around and say, hey, brother, sister, do what you want, but know this, there's a limb right there. Yeah. And too often I think we don't give those ahead of us a vote.
You look at the whole structure of how businesses are run in this country and maybe worldwide, but I know certainly in this country, you know, everybody works hard till they get to this point in their life and then they want to retire. And instead of the companies embracing those people and keeping them around to mentor younger people, they just discard them. So then the whole cycle starts over again. You got to relearn. You got to make the same mistakes. I see it in the coaching field. I mean, people are still doing stupid stuff that was done 50 years ago. There's no need for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, my career was built by two gentlemen that weren't old when I started, but they imparted that wisdom on me, Gary, and they said, no, that you're not going, that doesn't work. Don't do that. And both of them are equally as hard-headed as me, and so they prevented that. And I couldn't get out of it. I tried. I wanted to make those mistakes, and they wouldn't let me. Uh-huh. What were you going to say, Schwartzy?
Oh, I was curious. What Gary? What were those stupid things?
Mostly it's just methodology. You know, how you train people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still goes on today. People think if you want to be faster and you're a sprinter, you got to get in the weight room. You got to push a lot of really heavy weight. And you know, I could get into the whole physiology of how you run fast here, but I mean, basically, if you want to run faster than the person next to you, you have to put more force into the ground in less time. Well, you don't do that by lifting heavy weights. Mm-hmm. Because when you lift heavy weights, you're putting a lot more force, but a lot longer time on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the things that we know now, we understand anatomically and physiologically about how the human body works. The information's there, but you gotta utilize it. And it just old ideas take a long time to die.
I was told this by the great John Ennis. 10 minutes of bad advice can cost you 10 years of your career if you're not careful. Be very careful who you listen to.
Yeah, you have to be real discerning.
Yeah.
And that's certainly a skill in itself. I mean, there's so much. I made so many mistakes when younger in my coaching career because I was always interested in training methodology and periodization and all those concepts. And there was a lot of stuff written about that back in the 50s and 60s of the last century. But a lot of it, well, I'll just give you an example. You know, there was a lot of information that came out of through Russian periodicals. Because, you know, the Russians were what everybody emulated in their training because they had all this success, particularly in the East Germany. But you could read of the things that they did, and they truly were the methodologies that they used. But if you didn't keep in mind the fact that there was a drug protocol behind that, then if you tried to use those same protocols with our athletes here without the drugs, you'd kill them. Right. You know, they can't do much work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, yeah, you have to be discerning in whatever information you get. You know, does this make sense?
Mm-hmm. Got to listen to the body too, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Interesting.
I remember Gary a few years ago we were talking about how you put together kind of a, I don't know, I guess a consortium of coaches where you'd get together once a year or so for like a camp, or I guess for lack of a better word, where you would discuss things. I mean, and these, of course, I found it fascinating that you would do that with in that situation. There was direct competition, but you were trying to help one another. You're trying to help develop athletes. Say in the Big Ten, you probably, whoever wanted to show up, we'd have a gathering, and then that became the seed stock for what we did here in Idaho with our saddle makers gatherings.
Yeah, we called it the Allerton Conference, and there was a place called Allerton Park about 30 miles away from the University of Illinois. It was basically a 4-H camp, and I could rent the facility for little to no money, and it had cabins, it had real rustic bunks. You know, he bought a sleeping bag,
mm-hmm.
and it had a kitchen, and I bought the food and cooked for everybody. And we would invite 12 to 14 people, and usually I was kind of selective on who I would invite because I knew that I would tell people, if you're going to come, you're welcome, but be ready to drop your pants and tell us what you do.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay? There's no secrets here. And the group was really good about that. I mean, we had some people that came in from Europe. We had some people that came in from Australia.
Mm.
And they had to pay their way there. Once they got there, I took care of their local transportation and their room and board. And we just camped there for like 3 days, no telephones. Mm. You know, it was just, you sat around and you talked, you ate, you drank some beer, and some people gave some presentations. And then we would all sit there as a group and tear it apart. And it was a great time. We probably did it for about 10 years. And then, I'm not sure why the concept died. Fired.
I just did that last week, but basically the exact same thing. Uh-huh. It's a TCA forum, but Benton Spur Maker forum. We had 9-10 people in here, and exactly like, there was no secrets, and different levels of individuals, and it's great creating a fellowship and community within the discipline, and we're all in it together and trying to get better. And you know, yeah. I hate competition of Benton Spur Making. Like I'm very competitive. I love competing, but it is against myself. It's not against other Bitten Sperm Makers, you know, and we're all in it together, and I'll share anything I have with them. And so,
and the size of that group, you said you had what, 9-10 people?
Yes, sir.
That's ideal. I mean, when the groups get too much bigger than that, then I think you stifle all that exchange and that conversation. It's like, just too many people.
We've had two gatherings with 150 people. It's awesome. It's a big old social, but it's not the same as 9 or 10, you know.
Yeah, too many voices.
Yeah.
So we even see that to an extent with what we're doing with our saddle makers carry. I mean, it's great to have 50, 60 people there, but probably most of the really good information that gets exchanged is after the sessions are over and people are sitting around the table, you know.
Yeah. Small conversations and people are comfortable. And let's be honest, I mean, it's a group of introverts. Mm-hmm. So how well do introverts navigate crowds, you know? Mm-hmm. Not so well. And so it needs to be a safe place for everybody to, like you say, drop your drawers and no secrets here, and let's just see how we can help one another. It's hard to break away. I know in my lifestyle, it's really hard to break away to do those kind of things. And I can only imagine the kind of preparation it took you, Gary, to put together that kind of thing. All the logistical things that probably sounds like it landed on you for most of it. So
yeah, it had its challenges. I don't know if there's the challenges then. I mean, we primarily did this back in the 80s and in the 90s. You know, people didn't have cell phones. There was no texting. There was no Zoom. There was, you know, people kind of longed to get together and socialize and share things. You know, today, I have a devil of a time just getting a saddle customer on the phone.
Yeah.
People don't want to talk. You know, I come to the point anymore, I say, if you don't get on the phone with me, I'm not going to start this project. Because I'm tired of working through texts and all this other stuff, because you just don't get a feel for the customer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do a lot through email and text now. But I can remember there was a time I would not start it unless we had a voice conversation between the two of us.
Yeah.
It was problematic.
That's a good point. I guess I'm becoming more comfortable with the whole text and email and stuff, but I totally understand what Gary's saying. You really don't get the full spectrum of who is this person and what do they want? What exactly, how can I serve their needs? How can I serve this customer in the best way? And that can only take place in a conversation, direct conversation.
You know, and to me, that's vital, because it's through some of those direct conversations that I've turned down projects, because you suddenly realize you're working with a person that's never going to be happy regardless of what you do.
Yeah.
And I've really, you know, I've taken a lot of those customers in the past and deeply regretted it. So I've tried to, that's why I like to talk to people. I want to know the personality I'm dealing with here.
I graduated college and it was always a scary experience leading up to the first test of the semester within each class, right? Because I had no idea how they were going to test. Mm-hmm. And so I was always curious of how that professor was going to test us on the information they had given us. And once I'd figured out where the test was coming from, how they were challenging us, it was easy. And I used that experience. I shouldn't say it was easy. It just was more predictable. But with my customers, that's what I do. What is your test? What is it that you want to know from me? Or what is it that you want from me in my work that will make you happy? So take that experience. Anyhow. Well, the ability to send drawings now is the one thing that has made it a lot easier for me to do through text messages and emails. Is I can give them a window into my brain as to what it is I'm going to create for them.
Oh, yeah.
Testing.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Those electronic medias are real important. In fact, I wrote a piece of software it's on a platform called Notion. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to program on it. And basically, I wrote a saddle planning file, you know, that's got all the options and things on it, and people can put pictures in it and whatever. And it's an interactive file. So I create the file, I send it to the customer. If they type something into it, I can see exactly what they've typed into it, and then I can respond to it. So we have a platform, and some people utilize it really well. They'll put pictures of their flowers, types of flowers they want in there, and they'll put pictures of saddles that they like. And so it's very helpful to have it all in one place, and the information's down there so that we can communicate real clearly. Yeah.
George, did you see the
Notion? I'll have to look that up. I haven't heard of that.
Yeah.
He just sent us a curveball. He's rolling. We went through the batting order one time, and he's throwing us fastballs, and he kind of it come through again, and maybe another dose of fastballs, maybe a changeup. I programmed my own software. Did he say that? Like, that's a big curveball. Where the hell did that come from? I never expected you to say you programmed your own software.
I used to write software for training. To help coaches design their training programs, and I sold that software for years.
There you go.
Yeah, but no, this is you don't have to be a programmer to work on something like this platform. They've made some of these platforms really pretty easy to use, and you still have customers that don't want to have anything to do with the computer, and I understand that. But then the ones that do, I mean, it's useful, because the problem I was having is people wanted to communicate through Facebook, through Messenger, through text, through email, and, you know, even some other apps. And I was just like, where, for me to get all this information, okay, where did they put this? Where did they put that? And I don't want to miss something. So this was an effort on my part to try to get all the communication going in one space.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Every customer has their own way of communicating to, whether it's Snapchat or Facebook or Instagram, and that becomes a bother to me, you know.
Yeah.
All the different platforms of communication.
Right? Yeah, I just don't have enough time in my day to keep track of.
Me neither. That's interesting. Yeah. So what was the name of it again?
Notion.
Notion.
Notion. Notion.
Notion. Interesting.
I could create one of these files and share it with you.
That'd be cool. We'll see.
And all I would need is your email. And all you have to do is go to Notion and download. It's a free app, and once you download the free app, then I can send you the file. You could open the file, and we could interact across it. And you could kind of see what it's like.
Wow!
Well, you have my email. It's on the email message. Yeah. So there you go. Interesting. I would like to see that.
Yeah. Cool. Hmm.
Well,
yeah. It's
we old dogs can still learn some new tricks.
We were talking about the older generations a while ago and the value of what they bring and all. And I said, I'm about to say something. It's probably going to get me in trouble because I don't want to call you too old. But the energies, when you find someone in the older generation that has the energy still left in them, the youthful energy to pursue and go, that's where real value comes from, right? Is like I you don't have that has-been attitude. You have you're still moving forward and going and pack the wisdom that you've gained over the years. And that's real value right there. And they're not everywhere, but that's okay.
It comes down to what we talked earlier, retirement, you know.
Yeah.
Were we recording when we talked about that whole thing? Retirement, you know, there's nothing... there's no mandate for that, and as long as you think of traditional retirement, could be a death sentence, and even if you last for years and years after that, are you just kind of taking up space? Is that what we're here for, to just kind of take up space in our chairs? Not me. Jeez.
I've made some mistakes because I've had that attitude, you know. And there's no slowdown. I'm just going. I'm having joy and living by the day and trying to be better tomorrow. I didn't plan properly for the changes that will happen with age, and I'm trying to accomplish that now through business and planning a little better for those different periods and changes in life, because I don't want to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning for the rest of my career, but I still want to maintain that attitude of energy and moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Through the different changes of life, you know, and all that. But,
yeah, I think, you know, as humans, we always kind of want to seek that level where we just kind of stay. You know, I'm comfortable here. I got my routine.
Yeah.
But we realize that we're biological creatures, and because we're changing, we have to change as well. We have to adapt to those changes.
Sure.
That never stops.
No. Homeostasis. Want to gravitate toward that all the time. So, Gary, do you have some kind of exercise regimen? Wilson's going to ask you something about cold water too.
Freaking cold showers.
Oh, Well, my routine every morning is I get up and I get up early. I'll sit here in this chair and I'll read my Bible. I'll do my study. And then when we start to get some light outside, which is about now, I take the dog and we go for out for a couple miles walk and feed the horses and chop ice this time of year and get a good fast walk in and come back and maybe eat a little breakfast, have a little coffee, and then head out to the shop. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my routine. That's my exercise routine. I mean, when I was coaching, I didn't have an exercise routine at all. I mean, I really neglected myself. And so since I quit coaching, I've just made an effort to make sure I do something every day.
Yep. Very important.
I quit running years ago because I wanted to keep my hips and my knees and my ankles. So I quit running.
Well, you know, my horse pen is a ways from the house. And it's not that far, but it's not at my house, right? And people, my buddy, why don't you put your horse pen way over there? I got to walk over there. And that's good, right? That's not a bad thing. It is a good thing to have to walk over there. Yeah. So what's the water at your house, Fortune? What's the temperature of the water? These cold shower things?
53, 54 degrees, probably something like that.
46 the other day.
46? You put a thermometer in
it? Hell yeah, it's the damn beet red and chattering my teeth. And dad, he's got me into this cold shower routine, Gary. And the way he convinced me was the mental thing. He was telling me all these health benefits and all that yada, yada, yada crap. And then he pulled the special warfare mental toughness discipline routine on me. And I've been doing it ever since.
You take contrasting hot and cold, or you just
I'll just stand under the damn shower and look up at it and turn it on and let it hit you, and it is freaking cold. Yes, because my water lines are 6 inches deep. You know, I mean, there's no reason for any. Now in the summer, I told you it was colder in the winter, and there's no telling what it was last night because it. We're 40 degrees all day yesterday and 40 today. It's going to be 30 tonight. I get in the damn shower. Yeah.
It's about 9 degrees out here right now.
I'm not going to tell y'all how cold I am at 20 degrees right now. I'm not going to get much sympathy from y'all, but just think of my 6-inch water lines, Carrie, next time you take a 53-degree shower. That's pretty warm.
that's what's going on there. You're just lower. It's closer to ambient temperature. That's what it is. But we ain't going anywhere with water lines that shallow.
No.
We're looking at, I don't know, 2-3 feet or whatever they are. I don't even know what the code is, but it's about 7 below right now here. So.
They're 8 feet at Scott's house in Canada.
Eight feet?
Yeah, 8 feet in Alberta.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, and Amy Erickson was here over the last week, and she said there were 8 feet at her house, too, and it was 5 below at her house in the mornings and things as well. So, yeah, chilly.
Refreshing.
Yeah, refreshing. You know, I'm bleeding into things, Gary. When I started the cold shower routine, you can't imagine how long this long neck I have would get, man. I'd stick that old head out there. Did not want to get the body in there, you know. Then
so how long are you staying in there?
Well, so when you turn it, the routine that Schwartzy has taught me is you turn it all the way on hot when you stand under it, but the cold water hits you, you wait for it to warm up, take a normal shower, and then at the end of the shower, turn it all the way to cold. And 2 minutes. So,
couple minutes.
So I may or may not get to counting pretty fast. You know? And so I go about 2.5 minutes of counting to make sure I'm in there 2 minutes.
Yeah, you know, I don't know.
He ain't taking the bait. I can't. No.
I used to have a coaching buddy up from coach at the University of Minnesota, and he was this Norwegian guy. He was about my age, and he would come to Allerton every year, and we had this lake outside, and we always had it in like the end of November. And he would come in, and he would just strip all his clothes off and run outside and dive into this lake. You know, it was 20 some degrees outside. That's just a no thanks. No. I just
can't go there. There's other ways to be mentally tough is what you're telling me. But
that's right. You know, I can put my thumb on an anvil and hit it with a hammer. But I don't have to get in the cold.
I will say there's, you know, I've had a stuffy nose, and when that cold water hits me, immediately I can breathe, and I have no idea where it goes, but immediately I can breathe. The air comes in, and it takes a while for the old stuffiness to come back. You know, I mean, it. There are some things about it that I'm like, It's not conducive for your wife snuggling with you after you get out of the shower, though, and you crawl in bed. She's like, hell no, get away from me. That skin is ice cold.
Cold fish.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Well, should we all go to work? We got 40 hours to put in. I talked about
Yeah, I got a short week again here this week, so I better get going. So,
well, thank you, gentlemen. That's it's been enjoyable.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
It's been really great, Gary. I appreciate all that information. That is all inspiring to me, the mental side. And coaches were just a huge part of my life growing up. So thanks for sharing that. That's really cool.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Cool.
All right. Well, you guys take care.
Adios.
Okay. Adios.